it's always a good idea to check yourself every so often. So I wanted to talk to an entrepreneur who's been looking at this space of AI as someone who's bootstrapped their own businesses. James Benham, who's written a book on bootstrapping your business, joins me on this bonus episode of The Business of Tech. Alinea Partners is your sales readiness assessment company. They identify untapped opportunities in offer development, managed services, and customer experience. They pioneered the secret shopper in the IT channel, and they want to help you get your provider going with instant value and momentum. Contact them at alinea-partners.com. That's alinea-partners.com. And remember, profit is not something to add at the end. It's something to plan for in the beginning. Tell them Dave sent you. Well, James, thanks for joining me today.
Oh, glad to be here. It's exciting to be talking about entrepreneurship and business and tech with a fellow nerd who's nerdy enough to have a lot of really cool gadgets behind you that I recognize immediately. I'm a collector of fun things as well. So always happy to geek out with a fellow geek.
Oh, well, I appreciate that. My I would be bad at my job if I did not have a cool studio to hang out in. So I'm going to dive right in because I actually want to sort of get your sense and your take on all the AI hype that's going on right now and get your, you know, get your position on where, what you think the value there is right now.
AI is something that those of us who love science fiction and who have been writing code for longer than 10 years have been talking about, thinking about, experimenting with for a long time. The difference right now is the uptake rate, and the actual capabilities are finally to the point that they're surprising a lot of us who have been playing with subsets of AI, like, you know, computer vision and speech to text and text to speech. And, you know, these are all components of specific forms of AI. What we've got now is some very easily consumable, consumer facing applications that perform remarkably well, not perfect as we've found out, but perform remarkably well. And so I think that we are definitely hitting a specific stride in AI that is, of course, I think, catapulting us inexorably towards general AI or the singularity. But that's neither here nor there. What we have now is some very useful tools. ChatGPT, of course, being one of them. Microsoft Copilot, you know, where you're looking at Copilot for writing code. Now they're rolling Copilot for Windows, where you're going to have an AI buddy that actually helps you a little bit more than Clippy did back in the Microsoft Office days 20 years ago. You know, Clippy was their attempt at a conversational bot to help you get things done in Office. Now they've got a legitimate bot who can actually write your paper for you, help you edit it, help you chop it down in size, or help you beef up the content. It's really quite remarkable what's being done. And so, you know, we are utilizing the heck out of certain forms of AI. Like, you can actually have AI write code for you, code that would normally be a not important piece of code where you want to populate a data set and you don't want to take the time to do it. It used to take 5 hours. Now it takes 10 to 15 minutes. There's some really, really fantastic utilizations of AI that are coming to bear through the chat interfaces.
So now that we've hit this point where adoption kind of has widely spread, what are you seeing practically? I mean, you work with a technology firm and you work with a lot of insurance companies. What are you seeing practically in the field on the business side that's actual implementations that you think are valuable?
Well, first, the lawyers are getting their hands on this. And so they're trying to box in the acceptable and non-acceptable uses on this in a business environment, because what ended up happening is people realized how much this could write, like just the writing capabilities, and people don't like to write things. And so they started copying and pasting a lot of, not in our company because we did not allow this, but they started copying and pasting a lot of sensitive content in without understanding the consequences. So certainly we've seen a lot of people using this to write papers, essays, reports, summaries, or to take them and edit them. I'm seeing a ton of usage around the use of this for sales emails, a lot of usage for sales emails and marketing emails. taking and polishing sales and marketing emails, which is a painstaking job. You're using these AI interfaces like editors, which is really, really neat. And of course, you can create your own private instances so your data doesn't go into the general data set. Definitely seeing the use of this for writing code, SQL code, JavaScript, .NET, you name it. This puppy can write a lot of code. It's just another language, right? And in fact, I think we're going to see some fascinating uses of the language translation and localization capabilities of a lot of this software. I went to a seminar recently from the Earth Species Project, ESP, where they talked about how all human large language models are fundamentally the same pattern. They took the top 10,000 words in every human language and they mapped them geometrically so that words were connected to other words that were similar to them. And the maps in every language were identical. When you actually mapped it out graphically, it looked like a hand. And when they lined all those up, right, they could say that this word, apple, was in the same place in every language. There's some fascinating things I think that are going to unlock the world around us that we really can't imagine. But there's some really super practical things that technology companies, of course, we see a lot of this, and it just manifests itself in the everyday slog that people have is editing emails, writing papers, writing code, editing code. We even did a fascinating experiment where we took some really old Python code and we had it upgrade it to the latest version of Python and then optimize the code, and it chopped this much code down to this much, and it compiled successfully in the latest version of Python. So I mean, it's able to do some really cool things that would normally take a couple, 3 weeks to do. It's a big deal, and it's a big disruptor for the knowledge industry. You know, when you have a lot of people who are copy editors, or they're producing 20 or 30 designers, they're producing 20 or 30 logo ideas, and you can kick that to an AI bot to actually generate your logo ideas for you or write copy. This is going to be a very disruptive tool for knowledge workers in both a positive and potentially negative way.
So what are those concerns that you're really worried about? I mean, I'll just give my biases. Sorry, but I don't think that we're actually going to be replacing people. I think we're going to actually accelerate people. I think when you take a people person plus AI is better than a person alone. But AI alone is not good enough and won't generally create the creativity necessary. I think it's an accelerant. But what are the concerns you have about putting AI into various, business applications?
If machines and automation really eliminated jobs, we would have record high unemployment right now, and we don't. We have record low unemployment, right? And that's the tail end of 200 years of industrial automation, both with non-computerized machinery and with computerized machinery. So I don't think it replaces people. I just think people are going to have to retrain and upscale. We've got more open jobs than people looking for them. So we need humans. We need humans to think. We need humans to be more productive than they've ever been. In many Western countries, we're on the verge of population collapse. Whether you believe that or not, we are. Statistically speaking, but anything below 2.2 something is population decline. You look at Japan and China, Russia, they're in population collapse. And so you've got a pretty large work burden that gets put on fewer people. And and you're seeing some consequences of COVID and people retiring and hopping out of the workforce, and that we've got more open jobs than people who are searching for jobs right now. So we continue to have a tight labor market, which means that all of these tools are going to help us actually continue to get things done. Right. I mean, it's so there are going to be people who don't want to retrain, who don't want to change what they do and how they do it. And they are going to be disrupted, but that will be their choice. Be their choice to not retrain, to not upskill.
Now I'm going to ask, because you brought it up twice, even without prompting, you've sort of brought up the AGI and the downside science fiction side stuff. Now I tend not to ask this, but I'm curious. It sounds like you may even have a position kind of on that doomsday spectrum. Do you? Where do you fall on that?
My dad said only the paranoid survive, and he said that to me enough times that it got me a little paranoid. You tell a kid that enough times, they'll get a little paranoid. I think we've got to be realistic that there's a downside to all new technologies. There's a huge downside to nuclear weaponry. There just is, right? Required a lot of legislation to protect ourselves from ourselves. That was a technology that could have wiped out the planet. There's a lot of there were downsides to carbon fluorocarbons, CFCs. They punched holes in our ozone layer and you know, we had to regulate those. I mean, look, I'm a capitalist. I'm like a really hardcore capitalist, but I also recognize that for capitalism to function, you have to have a minimally regulated government framework that allows it to grow and scale and flex. And so, you know, we're going to have some big downsides on this that are going to have to be regulated. And so I think all of these technologies, and AI is going to be one of those ones that we're going to have to have a common set of framework around privacy and data ownership. And you're seeing that right now in the litigation that's occurring between content owners and the companies that are scraping that content to train all their AI machine learning models, like in all their AI models in general, right? They're consuming vast troves of content, including copyrighted books. Now, I'm a book author, right? So I don't want my book scraped for unrecognized content, no revenue at all whatsoever, so that it could train a bot and it can use my content in a response on a question. You know, so there's a lot of things being worked out between the publishing houses and the intellectual property ownership conglomerates around who owns the data too. Those can be quote unquote doomsday scenarios. The big doomsday scenario that the fearmongers like to shove in everybody's face and is really the fearmongering around jobs disappearing permanently. And I just don't think that the last 200 years have yielded enough evidence to suggest that would happen. We have more vacation time, more sick time, more leisure time than we ever have, and we have the lowest unemployment rate in recorded history.
Well, all positive, and I think we're simpatico on a lot of the thinking. I always describe it as like, look, you know, I'm a full-throated capitalist, but I want guardrails so that the state of play is fair, and that we can all compete, and we understand. And there are some questions that, you know, do need to get discussed with more than just the individual businesses. There are larger questions. Now, I want to actually pivot a little bit here, because one of the other things that you've spent a lot of time focusing on is the idea of bootstrapping businesses. And I actually want to pivot, you know, here, but it's connected, because this is one of those new technology areas where people have to make some level of investment, be it in skills, in education, and potentially in technology to get there. But if you're running the kinds of businesses that are bootstrapped, that generally thematically are often cash strapped, you know, how do you combine those two needs to invest in innovation while at the same time bootstrapping yourself up as a business owner?
Yeah, in bootstrapping, the reason I wrote a book about it, it's called Be Your Own VC, was because I really felt like there's a lot of books and a lot of discussion around how to put a pitch deck together and raise money. And there's not a lot of discussion about the fundamental tools needed to take nothing and turn it into something, or take a little bit of something and turn it into something. You know, we started this business with $5,000 in my dorm room. I used the $5,000 to buy a computer and some equipment and to fund my first few weeks of operations. I built a service business that allowed me to generate a profit. And then I consumed years and years and years of profit to build a product line. And then we took that product line to market in 2006. Became the second largest bidding network in North America for construction, and sold it in 2018. And so you know, we consumed a lot of capital to get there, but we generated the capital that we consumed with the services we delivered, right? Which is our bootstrapping model. I think bootstrapping and innovation go well together. It's just the slow, painful way to innovate. The reason I think they go well together is that you're generally building a machine that can actually run on the fuel that's in the tank, rather than needing the tank constantly refilled with fuel from someone else. And so I think that's one of the key things, is that bootstrapping builds efficient machines, not just machines that are high growth. And if you look at, and look, full disclosure, I'm a limited partner in a few different VC funds. So I invest on the other side of this as a VC, because I recognize where returns are, and I'm a capitalist. But I strongly recommend bootstrapping principles to all the companies that we invest in, because they help them become more capital efficient. Growth at all costs is wonderful as long as greater fool theory applies, right? As long as there's a greater fool willing to pay a higher valuation than you paid, even though the company is not generating a profit yet, it works out great. But you're looking at what happens on the opposite side of that market. You got a bunch of people on the tail end of the market, because the ultimate tail end of the VC market, because venture capital, private equity, then the public markets. The public markets are being very critical of companies that can't generate a profit, and they're not willing to pay the high multiples. And so when you don't have that big out then it compresses all the valuations below it. And you see a whole lot of venture capital backed companies getting very concerned and trimming their workforces back about becoming cash flow neutral or cash flow positive. So I think bootstrapping really helps you build efficient machines that can last. At the same time, it's a very painful, very slow way to build a business. Growth at all costs allows you to build a high growth enterprise that can really do rapid market acquisition. I mean, look, ChatGPT, OpenAI, I mean, they've consumed an incredible amount of capital before they started generating revenue. And I'm not sure that would have been possible, like the giant quantum leap they did without venture capital. I don't know how they would have bootstrapped their way into what they did. And so I think there are some things that just really need outside capital. There's a lot of things that do not. And you end up with this wonderful thing at the end of the day if you bootstrap, and that's called control. You have control over your enterprise. And so it allows you to make your own decisions and pivot and change without having to go raise another round.
Well, that's a good place to end that. So, Jim, if people are interested in learning more, where's a set of resources for them to find that?
Yeah, you can find out about me and the book at jamesbenham.com. Looks like B-E-N-H-A-M, jamesbenham.com. My company is called JB Knowledge. We've got almost 300 teammates, and we build software for the insurance industry. I've got a couple products, and really enjoyed being on the show. Thanks for sending people our way. And of course, I'm very active on LinkedIn. You can just type in James Benham. I should be your number one search result under James Benham. So let me know if you need anything there.
Awesome. James, thanks for joining me today.
Thanks. Appreciate it. And my podcast is called The InsurTech Geek. Check it out.
Partner Hero is an outsourcing company that goes beyond industry norms to prioritize employee empowerment, career growth, and quality performance. They pay above market salaries and have a management team that includes individuals from the startup world, making them more than just a service provider. They're also a thought partner for startups. With flexible terms to let you scale quickly and offices around the world for global coverage, you get a thought partner for your business with quality assurance baked into every program. You know, I believe in outsourcing. It's what IT services is all about. If you're ready to bring in outside customer support help for your startup that feels like it's part of your existing team, check out Partner Hero. Head on over to partnerhero.com/businessoftech to book a free consultation with their solutions team. Mention you heard about Partner Hero from Business of Tech, and they'll waive the setup fee. The Business of Tech is written and produced by me, Dave Sobel, under ethics guidelines posted at businessof.tech. Like the content? Support the show at patreon.com/MSPradio or buy our Why Do We Care merch at businessof.tech. If you want to reach our listeners, visit MSPradio.com/engage.
Part of the MSP Radio Network.